Unnecessary housekeeping. So you should have a set of notes for lesson 166, analyzing the pre-1611 evidence for the text, manuscript 98, physical description and contents. Okay, so let's just get right into this in the introduction. Back in lesson 162 and 163, we began looking at three work in progress primary documents, namely Manuscript 98, Bod 1602, and the notes of John Boyce. I said that we were going to consider each one in terms of the following three categories. So those three categories were scholarly awareness and published access, physical description and contents, and then impact on the readings found in the King James Bible. We were going to look at all three of those things. I stated that back in lesson 162 and 163. Having accomplished the first of these three tasks in lessons 162 and 163, for all three work in progress documents noted above, we deviated from my original plan in lessons 164 and 165 to cover additional work in progress documents that I was only recently made aware of. So just think with me if you would. Back when I did 162 and 163, I didn't know about what we went over the last 2 weeks. About these additional documents, okay? I was not aware of that information. That information was presented to me. I read it. I studied it. I determined it's important enough to include. So we took a slight deviation from what I had originally started to do in lessons 162 and 163. So we were going to look in those lessons at all three of these points, scholarly awareness and published access, physical description and contents, and impact on the readings found in the King James Bible. We were going to look at all three of those categories or all three of those points for all three of the documents. Manuscript 98, Bod 1602, and the notes of John Boyce. Then in the middle of that, I became aware of this additional information. So we deviated a little bit from my original plan in lesson 164 and 165 to look at that information. So if you look at your notes, second dark bullet, having accomplished the first of these three tasks, I say how I deviated from this. But we deviated from my original plan in lessons 164 and 165 to cover additional work in progress documents that I was only recently made aware of. Now, specifically, what are we talking about? Well, the first one was manuscript Ward B in the possession of Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, which is the first draft work of Samuel Ward, that should say, not Wade, Samuel Ward on 1st Esdras and Wisdom 3 through 4. And we looked at that in lesson 164. Then last week, we looked at manuscript Burney 363 in the British Library, which possesses the Boyce-Casaubon correspondence from late 1610 or early 1611. And we looked at that as they're discussing certain sections of the Apocrypha in their correspondence. Right? Completeness dictates that we also note the following yet understudied, I say understudied, meaning there's more work to be done on them, okay? Understudied, unclassified works that could one day be added to our list of primary work in progress documents pending further study. Those are the Greek Old Testament at the Bodleian Library with copious marginal notes by John Boyce. Again, we're not sure where that fits in the time frame. And the second is Isaac Casaubon's notebooks, also at the Bodleian Library, recording conversations that he had with another translator, Andrew Downs. So there's still some things about those that are outstanding. We need to know more information about them, but I'm noting them here again for you just for a complete, I want the noted list to be as complete as it can be at this time, all right? So in this lesson, I want to resume our study of the original three work in progress primary documents and consider them in terms of the following categories. Number one, physical description and contents, and number two, impact of the readings found in the King James Bible. So if I could just scroll up here, so what we are going to resume today is what we originally started up here in lessons 162 and 163, okay? So, bottom of page one. Before commencing our investigation into the physical description and contents of manuscript 98, prudence dictates that we review our findings from lessons 162 and 163 regarding scholarly awareness and published access. So, we know that manuscript 98, absolute last point on page 1, manuscript 98 was logged in the Lambeth Palace Library by 1647. So it is noted in the library record by 1647, manuscript 98. All right? So it's there. So it's sitting there from at least 1647 all the way through the rest of the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, the 1900s. You get the point, okay? So look at the top of page 2. Scholarly awareness discovered by E.E. Willoughby in 1955. So we talked about that back in lesson 162. Remember, I brought in that big oversized book that only 290 copies were ever printed, that I paid a lot of money for, to show you guys what I was talking about. Discovered by E.E. Willoughby, and by the way, I was going to bring it in again, but I want to try to limit how much I'm transporting that book. It's an awkward-sized book, and it's already old, and I don't want it to, fall apart or something. So I did not bring it in again, but I have already showed it to you, and I've also showed the folks online. So again, manuscript 98 was discovered by E.E. Willoughby in 1955. Briefly described and discussed in his 1956 monograph, The Making of the King James Bible, a monograph with comparisons from the Bishop's Bible and the manuscript annotations with an original leaf of the Great She Bible of 1611. So, it's logged, just to keep it simple, manuscript 98. It's logged in the possession of Lambeth Palace Library by 1647. Okay? It's not until 1955 that Willoughby figures out what it is. He writes a book about it, brief description of it in 1956. And that's again by Willoughby. Is there two L's there or one? There's two of them, okay? So it's logged, 1647, into the possession of the library. It could have been there before that, but we know that it's on a register by this date. And it sits there until 1955, when Willoughby sort of figures out what he's looking at, okay? And then he writes about it briefly in his monograph from 1956. So let's go to published access. In 1977, Ward S. Allen published Translating the New Testament Epistles, 1604 through 1611, a manuscript of King James's Westminster Company for Vanderbilt University Press. Allen's work is a full collation of manuscript 98 against both a 1602 Bishop's Bible and a 1611 King James Version. So, 1977, Allen is going to publish the first work, okay? It's published in 1977 by Allen, and that is this book right here, Translating the New Testament Epistles. Okay, I only have it in this format, and you can see down here that this is dating from 1977. This was the year I was born. So it's a great year to write a book like this. Okay, it tells you how old I am too, all right? Now, so we've already covered that, and we did it back in lessons 162 and 163. Okay, let's finish this point. Allen's work is a full collation of manuscript 98 against both a 1602 Bishop's Bible and a 1611 authorized version. Today, one can view select pages of manuscript 98 on the Lambeth Palace Library website. Manuscript 98 also received the briefest of mentions in Olga S. Olpoff's 1982 publication, The King James Bible Translators. Okay? So here is the website. I showed you this before. So this picture is also in your notes, as you'll see in a minute, but here is the title page to manuscript 98. We are on the Lambeth Palace Library website, and they've released about 10 images of this manuscript on the website. Unfortunately, they don't have the whole thing, but they have about 10 pages, okay? Now, I'll say more about that when we get to the appropriate spots, but you can view this. Here's what it looks like in its binding. At some point it was bound, and it is in the possession of the library. It says right here, Pauline and Catholic Epistles on the spine, and this is what it looks like. And again, this is the title page if you were to open it up and look at the inside cover. So it's an English translation of the epistles of Paul the Apostle and James, Peter, 1st and 2nd, of John, 1st, 2nd, 3, and Jude. So it is of the New Testament epistles and it is the work of the Second Westminster Company that is in this particular document. Now, any questions about that? Now, this these notes that are live right now, there are links in these notes to the website. So if you look at the first point now, under physical description and contents, it says to view publicly released images of manuscript 98, please click here, and then that would take you to this website where you can view the released images for yourself. All right. So does anybody have any questions about that review? So let's just recap quick. It's entered into the possession of Lambeth Palace Library in 1647. Could have been there before that, but we know for sure it shows up on a registry in that year, okay? It sits there till 1955 when Willoughby figures out what it is. He writes about it briefly, Willoughby does in 1956 in his book, and then it is finally studied in full and released by Allen in 1977 in Translating the New Testament Epistles, which again is this book right here, okay? So let's actually talk about what this thing is now. Any questions, I should say, before we move on? No? All right. Chapter 4 of Manifold Greatness, The Making of the King James Bible, edited by Helen Moore and Julian Reed, is titled Materials and Methods. In this section, in the section titled Preparing the Text, the three main work-in-progress documents are briefly discussed. The following is stated regarding manuscript 98. The second material witness, and I just have a note there in brackets that they talked about Bod 1602 first. The second material witness to the making of the translation is a manuscript deposited at Lambeth Palace Library in the 17th century, Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98. This manuscript is entitled An English Translation of the Epistles, with the first four words added in a different hand. Okay? Now you can see that right here. Whoever wrote an English translation of has different handwriting than whoever wrote this. Okay? So that's what they're saying there in that statement. Alright? So the manuscript is entitled An English Translation of the Epistles, with the first four words added in a different hand, and contains the letters of Paul, James, Peter, John. And there's three pages of pictures that come next. I'll comment on that. And Jude. This section of the translation was the work of the Second Westminster Company headed by William Barlow, whose account of the conference at Hampton Court was recorded in the Sum and Substance. Manuscript 98 represents the work of the translators in its first stage, and it was probably copied for the purpose of reviewing the translation. Each page is ruled with red lines into four columns. The center two columns fill most of the page, with margins to the left and right edges and top and bottom of the page. So let's look at that, okay? So this page here, I'm switching the page online, and I'm going to, let's see what this image generates. So this is Romans 1, okay? So I'll try to zoom in here a little bit. So you can see, just try to square that up. Here you can see the insignia again of Lambeth Palace Library, and you can see that it is ruled. You have a margin here. You have a left margin here. You have the left column that has the handwritten script in it. Then you have a right column that is blank and a right-hand margin. And you can see that it has been basically squared off and ruled off in this way. Every page in the manuscript is like this. Okay? They all have this appearance to them. So let's go back. The manuscript is copied in a neat secretary hand. Okay, so we can see the handwriting here of whoever wrote this down. All right, so let me see here. Where are we at here? The center two columns fill most of the page with margins to the left and right edges, as I just said, and top and bottom. Only the left margin and left columns are used, leaving the right half of the page blank, presumably for annotations. So, only the left column and the left margin have writing in them. throughout the whole thing. The right column and the right margin have nothing written in them throughout the entire document. Okay? The manuscript is copied in a neat secretary hand with clear chapter divisions and each verse starting on a new line. You can see that right here. Verse 1, verse 2, verse 3. Everybody can see that, right? Do I need to make that scroll up? Okay. Although the number of each verse is recorded, the space for the translation is sometimes left blank. So we can see that right here. We have Romans, first chapter. We have verse 1 written out. Verse 2, there's what?
Blank.
Nothing. It's blank. And then we go to verse 3. Okay, now that's, let me just say, that's not because they didn't think verse 2 should be in the Bible. There's a different reason for that, which we'll talk about here shortly, okay? But you can see that each verse starts on a new line, and sometimes the number is given, but the space is left what?
Blank.
Blank, okay? Back to the notes. This suggests, so although the number of each verse is recorded, the space for the translation is sometimes left blank. This suggests that manuscript 98 was to be used in conjunction with a copy of the bishop's Bible, which was presumably to be followed for these missing verses. Okay? Now, what do we already know about Rule 1? Rule 1 said to follow the bishop's Bible and alter it as little as the truth of the original would allow or would permit. Okay? So, I'll show you very plainly here, I think definitively and conclusively, that this document is made to work in conjunction with a bishop's Bible. Okay? Any questions so far?
Is this handwritten by somebody?
Oh, yeah.
And then would that be maybe like a scribe that didn't prepare this for multiple people to use?
So I would say that this was prepared for the company, for company use, for everybody in that company to keep tabs and a record of what they were doing as a group.
Yeah, that's what I was
Okay? And that's what he's saying here, Bart, on page 2. When he says that the manuscript is copied in a neat secretary hand. So in other words, some sort of scribe or quote-unquote professional person is writing this out. Okay? Let's go to top page 3. The following is an image of the title page from manuscript 98. Note the two different hands pointed out by Moore and Reed. So, if you're following in the notes, there's an image of that. That's the same thing I just showed you on the website. This is a photo that I screenshot from the website. That's where I got it from, okay?
That English translation of, that looks like that could have been maybe much later after.
Yeah, maybe the library.
Because that looks pretty solid.
Well, it's certainly written with, I would agree, I think it suggests it was not originally there. And somebody put it there later, whether it was one of the company members or somebody else. But the handwriting is darker. The type of pen seems to be, the hand was heavier in the way that it wrote it, and the handwriting is not the same.
Right.
So we can't know for sure. Anything we say would be somewhat speculation. But I would agree, it appears that this was added later. So bottom of page 3. Regarding manuscript 98, Olga S. Oakfeld wrote, quote, at the Lambeth Palace Library, manuscript 98 is a translation of the epistles, which, as Ward Allen puts it, sheds some light on the way the translation may have taken. The manuscript designed so that it could be circulated, I think that should say be a circulated book, no, could be circulated, that's right, could be circulated book by book, and so that comment could be written down, was undoubtedly prepared for circulation to other committees and other learned men. As Edwin Willoughby, that's our guy, E.E. Willoughby, points out, in preparing the text, the translator simply rewrote a verse when they decided to amend the verse of the bishop's Bible reading of it. But they left the number of the verse and a blank when the verse was satisfactory to them. Okay? So let's go back here. What Willoughby is saying then is that if they don't think that verse 2 needs to be changed. So in other words, if they accept the bishop's reading as is, they just put a number 2 and left it what?
Blank.
Is everybody following that? Okay? Back to the notes. But they left the number of the verse and a blank when the verse was satisfactory to them. According to Ward Allen, manuscript 98 also contains 179 marginal readings in the epistles section of the King James Bible. In 1977, he, Ward Allen, made a meticulous collation of this manuscript with the Bishop's Bible and the King James Bible, and concluded that it was prepared when the Second Westminster Company had passed, quote, the halfway mark in its revision, in its revisions, it should be a closed quote after revisions, and was, quote, in act of rubbing, polishing, and shaping the prose. He adds, a study of the manuscript brings home the wonder of the finished work. So let's just understand what we're looking at here. We're looking at the actual work in progress work of the translators. Okay? This is what they originally thought it should be when they went through it the first time. Now we know that the whole process of translating the King James Bible doesn't have an entire series of revisions and checks built in as they work individually and in companies, and then a final general review later on at the very end of the process. Okay? But as it stood, through what appears to be their first draft, the company, the Second Westminster Company that is working on the New Testament epistles, this is the document that they produced to capture their work at that point. Does that make sense? Okay? Three kinds of marginal notes can be found in Manuscript 98, according to Moore and Reed. Alternative English translations preceded by or, literal Greek meanings for idiomatic words preceded by gr, and alternative readings of the originals indicate by some copies read. Consider the following image taken from 1 Corinthians 8. So I'm going to go back here and I'm going to scroll down and we're going to look at the image. So I got this about as big as I can. You can see here in the margin, the left margin, it says or. See that? So here they're recording, that's the first category there, of an alternative English reading. So they have the verse, they have it marked, and then they go to the margin and they have or. So in other words, this could be another acceptable what?
Translation
or reading, okay? And then we can see another one here. If we go down just a few verses to verse 8, 1 Corinthians 1, 8, we can see Greek notes scrolled in the margin next to this verse, talking about the idiomatic uses of Greek words. Okay? And then if we go to the next verse, we see another note on verse 9, again marked or, noting another alternative English reading that they are proposing, possibly. Is everybody following this? Okay? So not only do you have what they think the translation, how they're amending the Bishop's Bible, how they're revising the Bishop's Bible, they're also capturing in the left-hand margin other pertinent, relevant information. Okay? Now, I've had the benefit of looking at these things for hours so far. Does anybody have any questions about this before we move on to the next point?
Is that English or am I just not reading it?
It's English.
Okay.
It's hard to read.
Yeah, it is.
First of all, it's all the old spellings. Second of all, it's handwritten script. But you can read it if you spend enough time looking at it. But shall something... I've spent a lot of time with more time with it on other parts than others.
So where does the or refer to? Can you tell? I mean, did they mark it in?
Yeah, I believe it's this mark right here.
Okay.
See the two slashes?
Yeah.
And then if we go up, there's a slash here indicating, I believe, margin there. And then there are, on this verse, there are also two slashes right there. So I'm thinking, from what I've gathered, that is the marking to tell them to go to, that there's an additional note in the margin. Or that marginal note refers to that part of the script.
So this is the same neat secretarial hand that we saw on the first image, correct?
Yes, same I would say.
And this is, I guess, the first go-through, probably comparing to the Bishop's Bible and adding some additional notes in the left margin about different translations or...
Different readings.
And they're now going to go and continue the second go at this and
Well, I'll prove that to you in a minute.
All right.
So this is first go through. So what this document is designed to do is capture all the thinking of the company after they've done their process the first time. Okay? Is everybody with that? Will, you're smiling. Is it?
It's pretty cool.
It is cool. I mean, this is, for a nerd like me, this is really cool because you can see what they are actually what?
Doing.
Okay? Look at the bottom of page 4. The true significance of Manuscript 98 resides in what it illuminates for us, in what it illuminates for us.
No.
No. I need to rewrite that sentence. The point is, it shows us the process. As Will's just sort of smiling and saying, wow, that's cool. It's because it's actually showing us in real, this is giving you a real-time snapshot into what they were doing and how they were doing it. Okay?
Maybe the process
for Bart.
So if they were in a committee and this is the Bishop Bible that would give them the full context, then they were just working on that page because the empties would make it kind of difficult to keep the context. But
so
they're only working on the changes that are on the worksheet, basically.
So here's a Bishop's Bible, 1602. I pulled this off the internet the other day. So I have my own copy now of what they were looking at. So I can look at Manuscript 98, I can look at what they had in front of them, and I can compare what's in the Bishop's Bible with Manuscript 98 with what ends up in a King James. You following that?
Yeah.
Okay. So yes, they have on the table in front of them, on the 1602 Bishop's Bible, the King's printer printed 40 unbound copies of the 1602 Bishop's Bible to give to the companies to work off of.
Okay.
So Manuscript 98 is designed to be a draft working in conjunction with a 1602 Bishop's Bible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, does that help?
Yeah.
Oops, that's not what I wanted to do.
Yeah, because when we first saw that, it was the opposite of what I was thinking. I was thinking, oh, they're going to rewrite that verse that's blank, but that...
So what that's saying then is they're accepting.
Yeah.
At 1 Corinthians 8:7, they're accepting the bishop's reading
as is.
No revisions. That's what that's saying. So we good on that? Page 5. The particular significance of Manuscript 98 lies in the insight it provides into the multiple processes of revision that characterize the translation. Within the text of the epistles, the King James, now check this out, the King James Bible makes, so this is only in Romans through Jude, the King James Bible makes 6,261 revisions to the Bishop's Bible. Manuscript 98 proposes 4,131 revisions, of which 844 were rejected, and 3,287 accepted into the King James Bible. Now, just let your mind roll around on that math, okay? Manuscript 98 here propose 4,131 revisions to the Bishop's Bible. Is everybody with me there? Of those 4,131, 844 were rejected. They said no. They ultimately said, no, we're going to do something different than what you've said here. Okay, you with me so far? Mm-hmm. And 3,000 of those 4,131 recorded in Manuscript 98, 3,287 of them are accepted and become the final text of the King James Bible. All right? In addition, another 1,765 revisions that do not appear in Manuscript 98 were incorporated into the text, into the 1611 text. So that is showing you multiple layers of revision. Okay? Is everybody following those numbers? David Norton, author of A Textual History of the King James Bible, also comments extensively on Manuscript 98, while some of his comments are redundant, when compared to what we have cited above, from Moore, should be an E at the end of Moore, From Moore and Reed, Norton provides some new details and deeper analysis of the document. Quote, one manuscript survives from this, the first stage of the work, Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98. The manuscript is headed an English translation of the epistles, but this is in a different hand from the rest and suggests that whoever did it did not know that the manuscript represented the translator's work in progress. So I don't know, that's a little bit speculative, but I included it anyway. Here's the dimensions. The paper is of high quality. It's 32.5 by 20.3 centimeters, taller and slightly narrower than the English A4. Each page is ruled in red, like a two-column Bible. A center line divides the page, and there are lines for margins at the top and bottom. Together with the use of a larger formal script for the titles in the early part of the manuscript, all this gives an impression of care and formality. Only the left-hand column and left margin are used, recto and verso, so half the manuscript is blank. Ample space is left for annotation and revision. So at some point, okay, at some point this manuscript was viewed as having served its purpose, and they moved on to some other way of keeping track. But it definitely is indicative of first stage work as they did this process, okay? Norton also offers his take on why Manuscript 98 was created. He says, quote, Allen's is the natural presumption that this was a manuscript for circulation and comment, but there is another possibility that it was intended as a master copy to be retained by the Westminster New Testament Company to be annotated as they received comments and suggestions. Either way, the intended annotation or revision in the right-hand column did not happen. Manuscript 98 appears to have been for a purpose that was not fulfilled. Or they decided to do it some other way once this was created. Professor Norton does not believe that the manuscript was ever circulated outside of the Westminster Company responsible for creating it. Now, this is his opinion, okay? I'm going to tell you his opinion. He could obviously be wrong, but this is what he says. The manuscript has some corrections, not enough to show whether it passed out of the hands of the Westminster New Testament Company. Allen details these, concluding that while such corrections prove that various eyes and hands scrutinized and corrected the text at various times, the corrections shed little light on the purpose of the manuscript. They show attention to spelling and punctuation, and occasionally words or phrases are inserted, but it is not clear that they go beyond changes an individual might make while reviewing his own work. One other characteristic of the manuscript is worth noting: the Q, okay, for query?
Querere,
French or Latin, or to question, okay, appears 35 times. So please consider the following image taken from the end of Hebrews 11 and the beginning of Hebrews 12, okay? So let me go to page 6 in the notes here so I can show this. Okay, so here's what we're talking about, guys. So this is the beginning of Hebrews 12. You see right here the 12th chapter. You'll notice that verse 1 is left what?
Blank.
But then you have this query, okay? This query notation in the margin, this upside down, looks like an upside down question mark or a awkwardly drawn Q or something like that, right? But you'll notice that that's in the margin, okay? On a verse that's left what?
Blank.
Okay? So here's what I want you to do. Open your Bible to Hebrews 12. And I'm going to find the verse. So I'm going to find in the Bishop's Bible, this is a 1602 Bishop's Bible, the verse that we're talking about is this verse right here. Whoa. That's too big. This verse right here, Hebrews 12, verse 1. Now, originally, when manuscript 98 was prepared, the verse was left what?
Blank.
At some point, somebody put a what?
Let's think about this.
A query notation that we need to maybe look at this again, right? So the first intention is to accept the bishops as is. Because it's left what? Blank. Then a query mark is put in the side. So I will read out loud from the 1602 bishops. You guys follow along and stop me when you encounter different language in your King James Bible from what I'm reading from the bishops. Does everybody understand what we're doing? So, Hebrews 12:1. Wherefore, seeing that we are compassed with so great a cloud of witnesses, all laid away... Stop. You should be stopping me, right?
Yeah.
All laid away that preserveth, or that passeth down, and the sin that hangeth to fall on, let us run with patience unto the battle that is set before us. Okay? So is there revision to that verse in the King James Bible? Okay? So what does that tell you? That tells me that when they were originally doing this, did they accept it, or did they think that it didn't need to be changed?
Right.
Then the query was added later, which prompted another look, which resulted in further what?
Revision.
So you can see there at least two, possibly three stages of revision. The first stage being when they leave it blank. The possible second being the query. Now, it's possible, I must admit, it's possible that when they left it blank, they could have put that in at the same time. It's feasible, okay? But we know there would still then be at least two stages of revision. So let's look at the first scenario first. Scenario one would be they accepted initially the bishop's reading that I just read to you without change. Then somebody goes and looks at it again and puts what? The query, which then prompts a conversation and another look at the verse, which results in the verse being what?
Revised.
That's one scenario. Another scenario would be it's left blank and that's put there at the same time, which prompts them to later on go back and look at it again. So either scenario, there's this showing you at least two stages of revision, possibly how many?
Three.
And you see how now we can look at the bishop's Bible, you can compare it with a King James, and you can see exactly how they're revising the bishop's Bible into what would become the King James. Now, when I read it, the verse to you, was it not in the King James very clunky? In the bishops? Was it not very clunky?
Yeah.
It's very clunky. Sounds much better when you read it where? In the King James. So did they, without a doubt, wordsmith it, so to speak, and improve it over what the bishops had? But you can see that they originally intended to accept it. At some point, the query note was added, and then the verse ends up being revised, even though it's blank in manuscript 98. Bart?
Maybe another alternative would be, since they're going to be revising that chapter later, and since that's the introductory verse, they might have wanted to revise the other verses and then make it read more compatible with their revisions.
That could have been the case.
I mean, just thought.
That certainly could be the case. At some point, there's doubt about the verse, which then prompts them to go back and look at it again. And initially, when the document was prepared, it seems like this was left blank and that was added later, although we have to acknowledge that it could have been at the same time.
But there was multiple people looking at it in the beginning, and they might have disagreed with each other a little bit.
And they might have just said, okay, we'll put this here and come back to it later on. That could have been the case as well. But in either way you look at it, there's at least two stages of revision here, possibly three.
Was that used anywhere else?
Oh, yeah, there's 39 marks like this.
The
there's 39 queries. I believe that's the right number.
Okay.
So 35. Will?
I was just going to mention or ask, and I was thinking through it as I was before I posed the question, but so there were some notes in there about, you know, particular translations or alternative texts, and they put in there or, you know, and maybe some other words to utilize. Is it more that the changes that were made were more like the flow of the verse on those areas where they put queries in, or did it sometimes go back to like textual differences?
It's both. It could be they just didn't think it sounded good in English,
yeah,
and they changed some of the English words around, and sometimes it is related to they think it's not as accurate.
Yeah.
It's not as accurate a reflection in English of what the Greek said. It could be both, and it probably was both. And there are times, where they originally accept a revision in manuscript 98, and then decide to reinstate what the bishops had. It's from the 1602. So there is all bunch of different scenarios that you see plainly when you actually roll up your sleeves and look at what's going on. Okay, now. Let's go to the next point. Regarding the verses marked Q for query, Ward Allen states the following in translating the New Testament epistles 1604 to 1611, manuscript from King James Westminster Company, quote, "While the corrections in the text of manuscript 98 leave unresolved the problem of the purposes for which the manuscript was prepared, the jottings in the outer left-hand margin do cast light on these purposes. The jottings are of four kinds. The letter Q, which stands for query, as we just said, or think this over. And one instance of a miscellaneous sign, Greek words, alternative English readings, and references to biblical verses. So those are the kinds of things that are in the margin. 35 verses have been marked by the Q. 25 verses are blank. That's like this one right here. It's blank, but it has a what?
Query.
A query, okay? 25 of the verses are blank. 8 come where part of a verse is written out, and 2 where the full verse is written out. So the queries sometimes are from a blank verse, sometimes for where just a part of the verse was revised, sometimes where they originally thought the whole verse should be revised, okay? 32 of the verses were altered after manuscript 98 and the notation Q were written. Revisions of these verses in the AV suggest reasons for citation of the verses. So that he's going to give you another example. At Colossians 2, verse 12, the bishop's Bible goes, "Buried with him in baptism, in whom ye are also risen again through the faith of the operation of God, who hath raised him from the dead." The Westminster Company had accepted this reading, but some other reader of manuscript 98 marked the verse for consideration. The AV reads, "Buried with him in baptism, wherein also ye are risen with him through faith of the operation of God, who hath raised him from the dead." So they originally seem to have accepted what the bishops had in Colossians 2:12. The query sign was added, and then they come back later and do they make another further revision to the verse? Okay. Please note that I added the bolding to make the changes stand out. In my copy of Allen's work, the left-hand margin is cut off at this point. The following is my best reproduction of Allen's work. Words in italics indicates words I provided as my best guess to what Allen had originally written. So my copy's not great, and sometimes I had to add a few words in here. So the ones that are in italics in the next sentence, I added them based upon my best educated guess. In manuscript 98 was written the clause, "In whom ye are also risen again." The AV changed it to, wherein also you are risen with him." There are three other points with which may have been the object of the Q at this verse in manuscript 98. The portion of also, the choice of you in place of ye, and not clear on the third reason, I can't make it out, but since there is a difference in the, since there is a difference of readings at a Q marked point, let us assume that revision of the clause was the reason for the marking of this Q. So in other words, there's a whole bunch of things they could have been pointing out, but the point is, do they rewrite the clause? And in fact, I think he may have a misprint here, because I think it should said, wherein, is it, somebody check Colossians 2:12. Is it correct here where it says, buried with him in baptism, wherein also you are risen with him, or is it ye?
Ye.
It's ye, right? Mm-hmm. So I think Alan has a typo here. I think that should say ye, because the King James does say ye there, not you. Okay? So, let's make sure we understand what's going on here. Whoever prepared manuscript 98 left a blank spot in the text for Colossians 2:12. So it's similar to the one I have up here for Hebrews. Okay? They left a blank spot in the text for Colossians 2:12, thereby indicating that the bishop's reading was originally accepted without alteration to the verse. Later, a Q was placed in the left-hand margin for this verse, noting someone thought the verse needed more attention. A comparison between the AB and the 1602 Bishop's Bible reveals the changes noted above. In this way, we can see at least two, possibly three levels of revision happening in real time. So do we have way more insight now than we've ever had before? The following is an image of the same phenomenon occurring in Romans 1:23. So this is the top page 8. We can see here, here's verse 23 is left blank. Then it's marked also query in the left margin. Okay. Originally, the bishop's reading had been accepted without alteration. Later, the verse was marked with a Q. A comparison between the 1602 bishops and the AV reveals that changes were made to Romans 1:23 after manuscript 98 was produced. For this, we can note at least two, if not three, different stages of revision. So stage one, the verse is left blank in manuscript 98. Stage two, it is later marked with a Q indicating the verse needs another look or needed another look. Stage three, the 1602 bishop's text was revised in the AV. Okay, so I will say this. I do not think that it is possible that the Q's were added at the same time that it was left blank. It's possible. I don't think you could say that, though, for every time it's there. We just don't know. It would be somewhat speculation either way, right? But there does seem to be, for sure, at least two, if not three levels of revision that are very plain to us that are happening here by looking at manuscript 98, looking at the 1602 bishops, and then looking at a 1611 King James. With these examples in mind, consider the following from the pen of Ward Allen. Quote, in manuscript 98, there are copied out 1,769 verses. All but 21 of these verses have some revision to the bishop's text. But where the bishop's text is to stand, the custom of the scribe is to leave space for the omitted verse. In manuscript 98, there are 1,013 such verses. The 21 then may have been due to some lapse in the scribe's attention. So in other words, is he doing all this by hand?
Yeah.
Is he probably going to make some mistakes as he's doing it? Okay. Elaborating upon this citation from the pen of Dr. Allen, Professor Norton offers the following observations. Quote, these verses are probably, as Allen suggests, the result of a lapse of attention and are most easily understood if the draft for manuscript 98 was an annotated bishop's Bible. This in turn suggests that the company intentionally recorded its work by way of noting changes on a copy of the bishop's Bible. If the revision process was cut short, then that annotated Bishop's Bible might have remained the company's master copy. Now, the 1013 blank verses are presumably places where the Bishop's Bible text was left unchanged. But perhaps the most important thing then about them is that Manuscript 98 could only have been used satisfactorily in relation to a Bishop's Bible. Okay? It appears to be made from a Bishop's Bible, and it presumes the continuing presence of that text, like Bart asked a minute ago. It only makes sense if this thing is working off of the Bishop's Bible. And by the way, what did Rule 1 say?
Just that.
To follow the Bishop's Bible and to alter it as little as the truth of the original would allow. So anybody who has said ever that they didn't follow Rule 1 had no idea what they were talking about. They obviously followed Rule 1 with a high degree of fidelity. Okay? The statistical evidence that one can extract from collating Manuscript 98 with the 1602 Bishop's, with a 1602 Bishop's Bible and a 1611 AB speaks to the mind-boggling and tedious nature of the work. Quote, Manuscript 98 is most illuminating as evidence of how much work was done in the first stage of revision and how much remained to be done in later stages. Allen gives the following figures. In the 1,769 verses that Manuscript 98 writes out, there are 4,131 revisions of the Bishop's Bible. 3,287 of these appear in the King James, plus a further 1,765 revisions not marked in Manuscript 98. That's a lot of revision, guys. All of this, when there are 2,782 verses in the New Testament epistles. So there's only in the section from Romans to Jude, there are total 2,782 verses. Yet they're making a mind-boggling number of revisions here to these verses, showing you the level of detail that they're putting into this, okay? Counting in the 844 changes in Manuscript 98 that do not appear in the King James, the later stage of the work made 3,818 changes to the work done in the first stage. So the two stages each made a similar number of changes to their working text, 4,131 and 3,818. Of the 6,261 revisions that the King James Bible makes to the Bishop's Bible text of the epistles, just over half come from Manuscript 98, 3,287, against 2,974. So do we know very plainly, mathematically, by collating the evidence out, that this represents about a halfway point, possibly, between what the Bishop's Bible had and what the King James ultimately had for Romans through Jude? You guys following this? Okay. Going one step further, Dr. Allen uses revision statistics to speculate where Manuscript 98 fits into the process that was used to create the King James Bible. Quote, after Manuscript 98 was prepared, there were some 3,000 changes made to its text before the text became that of the AB. The general meaning scrutinized 453 points in the epistles and made 257 changes. Now that's coming from Boyce's notes, okay? Between the time that Manuscript 98 was prepared and the time it reached the general meaning, some 2,750 changes were made. Now, it is not at all certain that the corrections on the manuscript are typical of all manuscripts which circulated. Some may have had more corrections, some less. But there's a chance that it is typical. If the manuscript represents the work that circulated amongst committees book by book, then we may assume that a single manuscript was sent to each member of a company. If each member of the company had a manuscript for scrutiny, and if Manuscript 98 is typical, then 30 readers supplied 1,400 corrections to be made by the Westminster Company, For the general circulation among learned men, from that there came 1,350 revisions. If the manuscript is one of those for the general circulation, then about 60 such manuscripts would have yielded 2,880 corrections to be made in 1609. While it seems impossible to ascertain for which of these two stages manuscript 98 was prepared, it is certain that the Westminster Company prepared a manuscript of its work at the halfway stage, and that the purpose of that manuscript was critical scrutiny of the work. Such scrutiny had been ordered by the rules furnished the translators, and such scrutiny, we know from William Eyre's letter, did in fact take place. However uncertain the placing of the manuscript in the exact stage of the history of the King James translation may be, there are direct lines from manuscript 98 to the general meeting and to the AB. Okay? Now I gotta keep going, I'm not gonna finish. So canvassing the primary work in progress documents is both illuminating and sobering. Ward closes his introduction to translating the New Testament epistles 1604 to 1611 with the following summative statements regarding the process and labor that went into creating the King James Bible. Quote, "The annotated Bishop's Bible," that's Bob 1602, "Manuscript 98, Boyce's notes, and scattered remarks about the work of the King James translators lead to the conclusion that these translators worked according to their instructions. Individual translators labored day after day over sheets from the Bishop's Bible. For 3 years, they gathered weekly to compare what they had done. During that 3 years, the Westminster Company revised the 121 chapters of the New Testament epistles. They made 4,131 changes, of which 1,344 were readings of their own invention." So that's their own reading. You can't find them anywhere else. Okay. "Of these inventions, 443 were rejected after the work passed under various critical eyes. The translators worked then at a rate of 23 changes per week, a fair pace when it is borne in mind that most of the changes were not radical, but there was other work to do. Each company read the work of all other companies. Manuscripts were prepared and sent out. When these were returned, the working sheets from each company were revised. Where there was disagreement between companies, and excursus was prepared. The work being completed, the manuscripts were prepared and sent out for the scrutiny of learned men throughout the kingdom. In the fall of 1608, these manuscripts were called in. During the year 1609, the Westminster Company reviewed the text in light of the revisions suggested by the learned men from far and wide. The work completed, the general meeting in London settled the disagreements between the companies, this work requiring 9 months. The members of the general meeting had 14 days for reviewing the epistles. During these 14 days, they examined the epistles, 453 passages, and made 257 changes. Thus they worked by the day at about the rate companies had worked by the week. The translation is handsome. The plain prose in the King James Bible hides its art. But plain prose require a high art to give the appearance of plainness. The plain prose of the AV has that art. Ornate prose requires control. The ornate prose of the AV has that. As we are told in the translators to the reader, that prose was brought to the anvil many times. Rubbing and polishing have brought the text to the surface, which is transparent. In manuscript 98, the translators were in the act of rubbing, polishing, and shaping that prose. A study of the manuscript brings home the wonder of the finished work. So, I know there's a lot to digest there. And wrap your mind around, but you need to understand, were these guys, did they follow rule one? Yes. Did they follow rule one with a high degree of fidelity? Was it truly the base off of which they were working? Okay. This document, manuscript 98, stands somewhere around the halfway point. And we can see multiple layers and levels of revision here occurring as we look at these primary work in progress documents. Now, what we're going to do next week is we're going to dig. I'm going to show you, and we're going to go through two passages, Romans 1 and 1 Corinthians 13, where we are going to look at the bishop's reading, the manuscript 98 reading, and the AV reading, and really understand what they're doing here as they go through this. Okay? Now, it is 10 o'clock. I need to quit. I need to pack up and vacate the premises for the next class. So I'm going to go ahead and close the stream down. And if you guys here in person have any questions,